Hello and welcome to Talking Aussie Books, a new weekly podcast shining a spotlight on Australian fiction. My name is Claudine Tennellis. As a writer and avid reader, I love chatting about books. And in this podcast, I'll chat to authors, publishers and readers, giving you, dear listener, insight into what's hot on the Australian fiction scene. So if you're looking for your next book recommendation or just want to know more about Aussie fiction writers, this podcast is for you. Grab yourself a cuppa, sit back and enjoy. Jessica Detman is a Sydney-based author of two novels, a blogger and former editor who turned her hand to writing novels when her children were born. Earlier this year, her second novel, This Has Been Absolutely Lovely, was released by HarperCollins, a wonderfully charming multi-generational tale that takes a witty and relatable look at parenthood and families that will have you hooked from start to finish. Described as Leanne Moriarty meets Jojo Moyes meets Marianne Keyes, you know you're going to be in good hands with one of Jessica's books. So it is with great pleasure that I welcome Jessica to the podcast today. Hi, Jess.
Hi, Claudine. Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on your second novel. I absolutely loved it. It was funny, poignant, and oh so real. And what about that cover quote from Kathy Lett? Are you happy with the reception the book's been getting?
I'm ecstatic. Yeah, I really couldn't be happier. It's been amazing.
So what was the inspiration for this novel? What was the seed that sent you down the path of writing Annie's story?
The initial inspiration for this, and I'm going to have to get people to go to the internet and look this picture up because it's worth seeing. There's a photo of ABBA. It was on the cover of one of their albums, their Greatest Hits album from 1975. It's a picture of the four members of ABBA sitting on a park bench. Now, I can still never keep their names straight, but the brunette and the one she was married to are Pashing. And next to them is the blonde one, Agnetta, I think.
Yeah,
and he's staring straight ahead with the most kind of dead eyes you've ever seen. And next to her is the one she was married to, and he's reading a newspaper. So you've got these four people sitting there. Two of them are having a terrific time. One of them is off in his own world, and only one of them is engaging with the camera, and she is staring straight down the lens, and she just looks bereft and lost. My friend gave me that picture. We went to Sweden together a few years ago and we went to the ABBA Museum, and so she sends me ABBA things from time to time. And this picture just, I just can't stop looking at it because the vibe of this person who is in a group, and, you know, the group is everything with that band, and the way they all play off each other, and she just looks so left out and sad. And that's where the germ of the character of Annie in this book came from. Annie is 58 when the book begins. She was a member of a three-person band called Love Triangle with her two best friends from school, Brian and Paul. As the name might suggest, Love Triangle turned into a love triangle and then turned into a different love triangle. And Annie was part of that, part of it the first time and not part of it the second time. And it just really made me think about where you would be in your life if you had been part of something so intimate and close as a group, a musical group like that, and that had ended, and with it some of the relationships.
So I'm an ABBA tragic myself. So I think it was Anna Frieda who was the brunette, and she was married to Benny.
Yeah, the one that looks like a bear.
And then it was Agnetha who was married to Bjorn.
Yes, that's right. So it's Bjorn who's reading the newspaper and Agnetha who's sitting there kind of pigeon-toed, hands in her lap, just looking so over it.
So let's talk about the title. Did you come up with that title or was it your publisher?
I came up with that title, and I think it was about the fourth title the book had. I started with a title that I now can't remember. I think the initial title I had for it was Housebound, because one of the main focuses of the novel is a house that Annie grew up in, and then her father grew up in the house, then she grew up in the house, and the book begins at her father's funeral where the whole family has come back together to this house, and then as the book progresses, they spend the summer there together. And there's a lot of questions about inheritance of the house and inheritance of various other things, and so everyone was bound to the house. So initially I was going to call it Housebound. That sort of changed as I went along, and then for a while it was going to be called Leave Everything to Annie, because the theme of the mental load and woman's work is quite a heavy one in this book, and because everybody literally leaves everything to Annie. to do. You know, that was also a play on the inheritance thing of leaving things to Annie. And then eventually I realized that what I wanted to say, to ask the question of sort of the statute of limitations on parenthood and caring for people, and whether that ever ends, because Annie is a great mother and she's been a fantastic mother, but she's done. She wants to stop having quite as much involvement in the care and looking after of her children and grandchildren. She's 58 now and her life, she's ready to start her life again after just decades and decades of caring. And this expression, "This has been absolutely lovely," was something that my own grandmother used to say. And she was the politest woman in the world. And when guests had overstayed their welcome, she would eventually just stand and look around at everyone and say, "Well, this has been absolutely lovely." That's a pretty clear sign that it's time to go for people. So, yeah, it sort of plays to the question of when is it time for people to just move on and let their parents be.
I've obviously read the book and loved it, but for those who haven't read it, can you tell me a little bit more about the story?
Yeah, as I said, it opens at the funeral of Annie's father, and she's an only child, so she has had the sole responsibility of looking after her parents as they aged. And she, as a young woman, started this band with her two friends. They went off to London, had almost had huge success. So their song, "Home is Where Your Heart Is," was selected for Eurovision in 1981. They would have been the British entry because Australia wasn't part of it back then. But then Annie was pregnant, and she was pregnant to her bandmate and husband, Paul, and it was deemed by the powers that be that it wasn't appropriate to see a hugely pregnant woman on stage at Eurovision. And so their song was handed on to another singer who performed it, you know, creditably, didn't win. And at that point, Annie and Paul kind of gave up and went back to Sydney. Their other bandmate, Brian, stayed in London, and Annie and Paul went on with their lives. They became music teachers, and they spent a lot of time going back to her childhood home so that her parents could look after their children as their three children grew up. Now Annie's kids are all grown up. She's at her father's funeral, and she's really starting to feel like maybe things are going to ease up for her. After her kids were grown, she moved back in to look after her mother as she became more and more afflicted with dementia, and then her father, and everyone's finally gone and left her alone. But then, of course, all her kids come back and bring with them myriad issues that they are experiencing as adults and young adults. It's sort of Annie's fight against getting dragged back into that world. And she's also starting for the first time in years and years to experience songs coming back to her. She hasn't written any music for close to 30 years. And something about this moment means that songs are starting to reoccur in her brain. She's had one of her own songs as an earworm for that whole time. She's never been able to get this annoying song out of her head, and it's her own song. Can you imagine how awful that would be? But suddenly that song starts to quiet down, and she begins to, yes, have inspiration again. And it's about the question of what you do with that when it comes and how you can grab hold of it when you have so much else pulling at your attention and your time.
The book was written from two points of view. There was Annie and her daughter Molly.
Yes.
So I wanted to know, how difficult was it for you to write two female characters at effectively two separate ends of the parenting spectrum?
It was really hard. It was really challenging for me. I found Annie a lot easier to write, which was a surprise to me because she's much further away from me in age. She's, you know, 2 decades older than me, and Molly's 1 decade younger than me. So I thought I would have an easier time writing a 28-year-old. But things are very different for 28-year-olds now than they were for me. And Molly's a really different kind of person to me. I have a lot more in common with Annie, the mother. Molly is an interesting kind of cat. She doesn't have a creative urge, and her mother finds that bizarre and quite hard to get her head around. And I think that's something that's pretty common for anyone who's got any artistic bent at all, whether it be music or writing or visual arts. You just sort of assume everyone else has that and should have it and that it's something to aspire to. And so, yeah, Annie really struggles with the fact that her daughter doesn't have anything like that in her brain. They clash quite a lot. It was hard to write those two, and I also spent a long time trying to distinguish their voices because it's all in the third person. And again, I went back and forth a lot of times between whether it was going to be first person or third person narrative. So yeah, that was definitely one of the biggest challenges in writing the book.
I have to say, I'm much like you. I definitely could relate to Annie a lot more than I did to Molly.
Well, Molly's a pretty annoying person. She's a bit all over the place. She doesn't have her shit together.
Yeah, exactly.
Frustrating to read about someone like that.
Now, Annie is a songwriter, as you've mentioned, and given the description of how lyrics and melody came to her, I wondered if that meant you had experience with songwriting.
No, I've never written a song, and I don't understand how anyone does. It just seems like absolute magic and alchemy to me. But I kind of guessed that it would be not dissimilar to how you write anything. You know, you get an initial idea and you play with it and then you expand on it and then you go and check that nobody else has already written it. That's something that really I find weird about songwriting, is like, how do you know that you're not just writing something that you've heard at some point and it's stuck in your head? That would constantly worry me if I were a songwriter. After I'd written the first draft, I talked to a few songwriters and they all said, yes, that's absolutely an issue, that you might have accidentally written something that was already a song. And that's something that Annie has to sort of relearn songwriting as she goes about restarting her career. A lot of that was guesswork and research. I listened to a lot of podcasts about songwriting and talk to a few people who do that. But no, I've never written a song.
Well, you did a brilliant job bringing Annie's character to life. I thought you must have had some songwriting experience.
No, but thank you.
I think one of the things that really struck a chord with me in this book was the fact that, as you've mentioned, Annie gave up her career, her dreams and aspirations as a songwriter to parent her children, only to be faced with the prospect of having to look after her grandchild or grandchildren. This is something so many people are grappling with these days, isn't it?
It really is. And that was another kind of jumping off point for this book, was that my mum was telling me about a friend of hers who does, I don't know, 4 days a week full-time caring for 3 little grandchildren, I think. I just thought, that's insane. It's so exhausting. But for a lot of families, it's the only way women can continue their careers during those early childhood years, is with huge amounts of parental help. But boy, that sucks if it's not what you want to do as a person in your 60s.
I have 2 adult sons and I regularly have this, not so much a conversation with them about it, but just letting you know that I'm not going to be that kind of grandma.
Just planting the seeds there. Yeah. I'm doing that already and my children are 8 and 10.
No, I really, really empathise with Annie on that point. You know, that real struggle that you do want to be there for your children, but, you know, when you've already given 1,000% to your children and child rearing process, the last thing I want to be doing is being a full-time carer for my grandchildren.
Yeah, and that's the difference, I think, is that it's not that they don't want to be grandparents, it's that they don't want to be a default parent again.
Yeah.
And that's, when you are doing so much primary childcare, that you kind of become a default parent.
Mm.
And that means you can't be the fun one as well. You know, it's the grandparents' prerogative to be the one with the treats and the, you know, lenience around the TV and all the good stuff. If you have to be the, you know, the proper parent, you can't be doing that. And that takes away, I think, from the experience of grandparenting.
Annie is such a different mother from her own, and her daughter's mother differently to the way Annie did. So I wanted to know, do you think that women struggle with the concept of what makes a good mother, maybe trying to contort ourselves and fit into what society deems to be the right kind of mother?
I think they absolutely do. Yeah. And I think that everybody parents in either response or reaction to how they were parented. And if you think you were parented really well, then it's pretty hard to step away from trying to do the same thing, even if the same thing may no longer be the appropriate way of parenting, or it may not be the best thing for your children, because everybody's different and everyone needs to be parented and looked after slightly differently.
I have to say that whilst Annie and Paul had a very amicable relationship as a divorced couple, Paul seemed to suffer no real guilt about being an absent father. Do you think that we have less expectations of men as fathers than we do of women as mothers in general?
I do think in general we do. Yeah, Paul as an absent father, and then as a person who's about to be a very absent grandfather, because he lives in the UK full time. Yeah, he gets off pretty lightly. He gets off very lightly. in this book.
Sure does.
Yeah, and it's frustrating, but I think it's realistic. I won't give away the ending, but he, there are things that he does do to make some amends, but really they're not big enough, all things considered. And I do think that obviously there are very different expectations on men and women.
And I think what I related to most in this book was the sense that Annie was never going to get out from under the weight of everyone's expectations, because she had a dream that was put on hold for 35 years, and she helped Denise the way for everyone else to achieve what they wanted, but there was always that sense that there was more. There's a scene where Annie is trying to get a song down and she gets interrupted by her ex-husband asking her inane questions. And I just felt that in my marrow. I think most people, especially creatives, would understand that level of frustration at not being seen, or that what you're doing or what you're trying to do is not inherently valuable, or maybe it's just that lack of respect, do you think?
Yes, I think so, absolutely. And it's, Annie is sitting at a piano playing it when this happens. So she's visibly doing work. It's just that it doesn't look like work to other people necessarily. And I think writers suffer that too, because a lot of writing is staring into space, which doesn't look like work either, and makes it look like you're ripe for an interruption. Mm. It's called thinking, and it's a big part of it.
Jeff, you were an editor with Random House and HarperCollins before you decided to pen your own novels. Yep. I was wondering if you could tell me a little about your journey to publication and how your experience as an editor helped or hindered you.
I think having been an editor both helped and hindered me. I mean, it helped because I knew a lot of people in the publishing world, which makes it easier to get your book in front of their eyes when it comes to looking for a publisher. So that, from that perspective, it was very helpful. It was also useful for me to know exactly how much an editor can and will do. Editors are magicians, as I think all writers know once they've experienced the glory and horror of an editorial report. If you know that once you've written a draft, there are people there to hold your hand and help you make it better, it just makes it so much easier to get to the end of a draft, I find. If I didn't know what an editor was capable of, I would have tried so much harder to make my first drafts perfect. And they wouldn't have been, because you can't see everything about your book. That's why you need an editor. But it's just so nice to know that there is this amazing backup person who will help you see the holes in your work and fix it. I kind of liken an editor sometimes to a building inspector. And as an author, you try and paper over, mold and cracks in your storyline, and you paint over things and you hide stuff behind furniture, and then your editor will just come and quietly remove all that and point out the things that you know are wrong with it already. You know they're all there. You just kind of want to get past them and not fix them. And editors are really great at going, you know what, we do need to fix this, and I'll help you do it. And the best editors are the ones who will make a suggestion for a way to fix something that needs fixing, but then they will inspire you to find an even better fix for it in the end. Sometimes you'll take your editor's suggestion verbatim and go with their wording, but a lot of the time what they suggest flicks your brain into a gear that helps you find a better way of doing it. So it was handy to have done that and known that there were really great editors out there, and that I wasn't going to have to be me who edited this book.
Tell me about your journey to publication.
I didn't start writing any fiction until about 4 years ago. After my first child was born, she's now 10 and a half, I started writing a blog about parenthood. And it was just past the heyday of blogs. And I thought, I'm just going to start writing and I assume I'll have 100,000 followers. And I never did. I never got very many at all. But the people who read my blog, which was called Life with Gusto — my cat's called Gusto, so we literally live life with gusto — the readers of that blog just were super supportive and lovely. And they really encouraged me and made me feel like my writing was worthwhile and funny, and they wanted more of it. So I just kept writing it. And I wrote it for years and years, and it never did, any great numbers or got sponsors or anything. I mean, I never monetized it in any way. But then when I was, 2016, I started to think that maybe I could put these blogs together as a book. And a friend of mine had become an agent, who was an editor with me, had become an agent, and she signed me up, and we started to approach publishing houses, again, all full of our old colleagues, with this idea of publishing a collection of the blog posts. A couple were interested, not in publishing the blog posts, because as they pointed out quite rightly, that was all on the internet for free and people could go and read that if they wanted. Why would they buy a book? But one of them at HarperCollins suggested that my voice would lend itself to commercial fiction. And I had always thought that I didn't have any imagination. I'd only ever written about my real life and truth. And I didn't know how I could tell a story. I didn't know if I had any stories to tell, but she very cleverly pointed out, she said, I said, I don't know how to write a plot. And she said, there's only about 5 plots. Just pick one of them and, you know, adapt it, which made me look back at everything I'd ever read and go, oh, there are only 5 plots, and be brave enough to start dreaming up some characters and putting them in some situations. Did that for a few months and came up with what I thought was a terrific synopsis for my first book, which was very heavily Moriarty, I would say. It was sort of a domestic noir. It had the same first 3 chapters as my first book ended up having, the book How to Be Second Best. So the first 3 chapters were pretty much as I had written them, but the entire rest of the book, including the entire plot, was completely different in the end, because I handed in this plot synopsis which involved death and people being buried in gardens and stuff, and my publisher Anna looked at it and said to me, she said, yeah, that's not the plot of this book, that's you trying to jump on the Leanne Moriarty bandwagon, isn't it? And I went, well, yes, of course it is. And she said, well, you know, books take a couple of years to write and that might not be the big thing anymore once this book comes out, so maybe stop trying to just copy and come up with what might actually happen to these characters if you followed them and their story, which I then went and did, and it worked out a huge amount better. So that was my first book, and they signed up 2 books at that time, having asked me if I had an idea for a second book, and I lied and said I did. So then I came up with this one.
Yes, I did have a look at your blog, Life with Gusto. So I wanted to ask you, how important do you think it was in helping you to find your voice?
Crucial, I would say. It really, really helped. It helped me hone my humour in my writing and empathy. And I was writing about real people, my family, but I also was writing in a way that it had to be okay for these stories to remain on the internet. So I was really, really careful to not publish anything that my children would find hurtful down the track, or that anyone else in my life would find hurtful down the track. So I think that was a pretty, pretty good long-term writing exercise.
So had you always wanted to be a writer?
Probably on some level, yes, but not. It was not something I really admitted to myself for a very, very long time, because my mum's a publisher, so I grew up knowing lots of writers and just being in awe of them. While I, you know, realised that they were real people, I thought they were better people with better brains than mine. And then I went to university and I studied all of the, you know, great dead male writers, and again, felt hugely inferior, and then became involved in publishing and worked with incredible people and just did not have the confidence. I think it was about 5 years ago, I went and had a coffee with Lisa Pryor, who's a fantastic former journalist who's now a psychiatrist. And I wanted to talk to her about career changes. And I said to her, look, I'm thinking of stopping editing and I'd quite like to be a writer. So I'm thinking of doing, a, you know, 3-year screenwriting degree. And she just looked at me and she went, Jess, when a man wants to change his career or do something different, he just does it. Women go and spend thousands of dollars and years of their life making sure they're deeply overqualified before they'll give anything a go. And she said, just don't do that. If you want to write, just write. You can do that. You can figure it out as you go along. You don't need to pay someone to let you write, which was essentially what I wanted to do. And that was really excellent advice from her.
So I wanted to ask you, are you working on anything else at the moment?
I am working on the beginning of a third book, yes. And I can't say much about it. It's got a connection to Shakespeare and it'll be a romantic comedy of sorts.
So Jess, there are lots of writers who listen to Talking Aussie Books, and given your experience as an editor and your own publication journey, I wondered if you had any tips to offer to those who are trying to get their novels written or published.
I do, and they're not tips that I knew back when I was doing that, trying to get my novel written and published, but that there is this amazing community of writers, and they're on Instagram, as you know, because that's where we connected. I had no idea that that existed. Instagram has really changed the way people can communicate with authors that they like. You can now be reading a book and finish it and be in that author's DMs 4 seconds later telling them what you thought of their book, which is both good and bad. But it's also a fantastic way of communicating and hearing about the writing process, because a lot of authors do fantastic content about their writing process. Sally Hepworth is one of those. She every week does Writerly Wednesday, where she talks about her process, and lots of other authors do that too. So it's a really great way of learning both things about the craft and just demystifying the whole process, I think, making it apparent that it's just work, you know. It's just sitting down and doing work all the time, bit by bit, and seeing lots of other authors who are, you know, you think are amazing, and they are amazing. Their work is amazing, but just seeing how they do it, and, you know, lifting the veil on that, I think is fantastic. And that's something that I love about Instagram. Also, it's a great way to connect with other aspiring writers and readers, and make friends with people who love books. And that seems to me a really great way into the industry.
So, Jess, if listeners wanted to learn more about you and your books, where could they do that?
I have a website, jessicadetman.com, and there's 2 T's and 2 N's in Detman. Or my Instagram is probably where I'm most active in social media. I'm also on Twitter, but I'm really frightened of Twitter.
So am I.
I go over there to get mad, and then I come back to Instagram.
Jess, I'm thrilled to have had the chance to chat with you today. I thoroughly recommend this. Has been absolutely lovely, and wish you every success with it and for any forthcoming novel. Thank you for joining me on Talking Aussie Books.
Thank you, Claudine.
Well, that's a wrap, folks. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave a review on iTunes or drop me a line via my Instagram at Claudine Tennellis or on my webpage, claudinetennellis.com. Thanks for listening. Until next time, happy reading.